Chapter 8. 2 hours later, we're sitting on hay bales in the back of a pickup truck, the wind whistling through our hair. We both ate well, and I got a doggy bag for dust, and even picked up some new clothes, then rented a room at a motel to shower and change. I managed to snag a burner cell phone, too, when Rex wasn't looking. But Malcolm didn't answer his phone, and I didn't want to leave a message, just in case someone else gets their hands on his phone. I hope he and Sam are okay, but it's impossible to know. Just another thing to worry about. Get yourself together, I tell myself. You've come this far. Just put one foot in front of the other. This is important. And what I'm doing is important. I'm sure it is. I've already seen how powerful Dust is just on his own. Finding the rest of the Chimera and reuniting them with the guard might turn the tide in their favor. It could easily mean the difference between victory and defeat, not just for the Lorik, but for all of Earth. However, if my people crack the genetic code, allowing them to breed an endless supply of new Vatborn soldiers with the Chimera's shape-shifting abilities, the fight is as good as over. One's death will have been for nothing. My betrayal would have been for nothing, too. So even though I'm tired, lonely, and feel like I'm starting to go a little bit crazy, I know that I have to get to Plum Island. I have to free the Chimera. If I can do it without getting myself killed in the process, that will be a bonus. Before I can do any of that, though, I have to get out of New Mexico. It turns out that's easier said than done. There's a train. Unfortunately, it only makes 3 stops, one here, one in Colorado, and a final stop in Wyoming. None of that was going to bring us anywhere near New York. The bus isn't an option either. The nearest Greyhound station turns out to be in Colorado as well, a town named Alamosa, about 40 or 50 miles from here. That's one hell of a walk. Rex suggests stealing a car, but besides the fact that it's something I have no idea how to do, it feels too risky. You can't save the world if you're in jail for carjacking. I briefly considered trying to rent a car, but without any credit cards or ID, I doubt we'd get very far with that plan. That leaves hitchhiking. Rex and I have the pallid, whiter-than-white skin of Mogadorians, and Rex has his military tattoo on his skull, none of which makes us particularly appealing passengers. But we both pull the hoods of our new sweatshirts up and hope to hide our more recognizable alien features. I'm not sure how well it works, but we also have a secret weapon. Dust has had the good sense to turn himself into the world's most appealing golden retriever, the kind of dog people slow down just to look at. Before long, it works. The third vehicle to pass us is a slightly battered pickup truck. It pulls right up ahead of us on the shoulder of the road. The middle-aged driver who rolls down the window has rancher written all over him, from the weathered skin to the calloused hands to the worn flanneled shirt and blue jeans. "Give you fellas a lift?" he asks. "That'd be great, thanks," I answer, stepping up to the passenger side. "We're trying to get to Alamosa." "Easy enough," he assures me. "Don't think I can fit all 3 of you up here with me, but you're welcome to hop in back." I glance down at the passenger seat, which is covered with a bunch of packed grocery bags. "Back sounds good, thanks," I assure him. I gesture for Rex to climb in, and Dust hops over the side after him. I jump in last, and then we're off. We're in Alamosa an hour later. "Where are you going in town?" he calls back through his open window as we pull up to a stoplight. "Anywhere in particular?" "The bus station," I shout back, and he nods. 10 minutes later, he breaks in front of a small red brick building with a big Greyhound sign out front. "Thanks again," I tell him as we all clamber out. "Can I give you some money for gas?" He waves that off. "I was heading this way anyway," he assures me. "You boys get home safe now." I wave back as he drives off. He didn't have to take us here or turn down our money. He could have taken one look at us and figured us for hoodlums. But this isn't Mogador. Here, it's not considered weak to help someone else. This driver is exactly the kind of person one and the other guard are fighting to protect, the kind of person my race wants to enslave or slaughter. I can't, I won't let that happen. So I buy 2 tickets to Kansas City. Dust is safely tucked away in my pocket, in lizard form, and we all settle in for the trip. As our bus speeds off down the highway, Rex closes his eyes. I look over at him and wonder what he's thinking. Part of me wants to believe that spending time with me and Dust has changed him, that maybe he's struggling with himself the way I once did, questioning the tenets of the good book that have been drilled into his head since he learned to walk. I wonder, too, if he wants to know why no one's out looking for him, if he's angry to learn exactly how disposable he is to the Mogadorians. I know how it feels. Eventually, I drift off to sleep. As I do, one appears to me again. I know it's not really her. Sometimes a dream is just a dream. But she speaks to me in her own voice for the first time in ages. "You're different from him," she reminds me. "You can't trust him. Hate is in his blood. It always will be." "It's in my blood, too," I say. "Was in your blood. Until you met me." When I wake up, I wonder if she's right. I honestly don't know the answer. Maybe I never will. Almost exactly a day later, we pull into Kansas City. Union Station is a big, imposing stone building, easily a city block in every direction, and I gaze up at it as we step out of our bus. "You think we can catch a train straight to New York from here?" Rex asks as we walk across the polished marble floor. I feel strange to be back in a crowd after the loneliness of the last few weeks. The place is packed with lots of people coming and going, including plenty of college kids. The hectic nature of it all makes me a little antsy, but I know it's a good thing. We can blend right in. "I don't know," I admit. There's a row of ticketing machines off to one side of the actual service counters, and I step up to one of those. When I punch in New York as our destination, I get an unpleasant surprise. "Nope, there's nothing that goes straight there," I reply finally, staring at the screen as if that'll make it change its mind. "We can get from here to Chicago, though, and then from Chicago to New York." I study the information a bit more. "It'll take 33 hours in all," I report, "and cost us about $300 per ticket. That's more money than I'd like to spend. It will leave barely any cash in our pockets, and I don't want to spare the time either, but I don't see much we can do about it." The way Rex sighs, I'm pretty sure he agrees. "Fine," he says finally, "just do it." As I'm about to hit purchase tickets, I see a strange reflection in the screen. Someone is walking by and glancing my way. I know because there's a faint flicker of pale skin with a dark band across it. Sunglasses. The rest of the reflection is dark, too. Dark coat, dark hat. Almost exactly like Mog scouts wear. Panic flashes through me, and I whip around, but I can't find the figure or anyone like him in the crowd. I get an idea. I change our destination to St. Louis. That's only $30 apiece instead of $300. And buy the tickets. I take the tickets but leave the receipt behind and turn away fast. Come on. Rex sticks with me without a word as we hurry down the hall to our platform. I keep moving to the end, then quickly push through the door marked exit, authorized personnel only. "What are we doing?" he asks as we step outside. Just as I'd hoped, we're in the rail yard itself. There are trains everywhere, and a few people loading luggage or refueling or just walking around checking on things. None of them pays us any attention, and I don't look their way more than a second either. The best plan, I figure, is to move fast and look like I know what I'm doing. Maybe I'll even convince myself. There's still Rex to deal with, though. "We're not getting on our train, are we?" he asks, putting a hand on my arm and pulling me to a stop. "What's up?" Well, the moment of truth. I square my shoulders. "I think I saw a scout," I tell him, watching him closely. And then I wait, and tense, gathering my strength. If he tries to grab me, I think I can use my legacy to knock him down long enough for me to lose him in the yard. But I'd rather not do that unless I really have to. And I still have Dust in my pocket. After a few seconds, that feel like forever. He nods. So what now? Now we hitch a ride instead. I gesture toward the freight trains on the other side of the yard. Surprisingly, Rex grins. All right then. And he breaks into a jog. I guess it makes sense he'd get into the idea of something as physical and as dangerous as train hopping. Ivan probably would have loved it too. How are we going to know which train to hop? Rex asks over his shoulder as he slows by the first group of cars. Are they labeled or something? I glance at the cars, hoping they have address labels or big destination signs like buses, but each one just has a number, plus stuff like the manufacturer and model. I don't know, I admit. I'm making this up as I go along. Rex snorts. But then I spot a guy walking around in a rail yard uniform, carrying a clipboard. I bet he'd know. Yeah? Rex scoffs, as we both slide between two cars so the guy won't see us. What, you gonna go ask him? The man's past us now, and as I watch, he heads to a little shack in the center of the yard and enters it, but not before hanging the clipboard on a hook outside. Not me, maybe, I answer, grinning. Dust? I pull him out of my pocket and hold him in my palm. He twitches his tail as if to tell me he's ready for action. We've developed such a rapport that it sometimes feels like he knows what I want before I know it myself. We need that clipboard. In a flash, he's a hawk again, arrowing across the yard. He swoops down, snags the clipboard between his talons, and then soars up into the sky. The few people who see him gasp and stare, but lose him in the sun, which is why nobody notices when he drops down to my shoulder a minute later. He changes back into a lizard as he lands, and the clipboard falls free, right onto the ground for me to scoop it up. Nice one, I say. I scan the list. Here, I say after a second, stabbing a finger at one line. There's a train heading to Philly in a few minutes. Track 12. All the tracks are numbered, and 12 is only a few rows away. Let's go. Rex nods, and we take off. But then he pauses, stoops down, and comes back up with a thick, blackened metal spike. To jam the door open, he explains. Sliding doors probably won't open from the inside. That makes sense. Of course, it also means that now he has a blunt object that he can use as a weapon. He doesn't try anything, though. We get to track 12, just as the train starts to rumble into motion. I quickly spot a boxcar and start moving toward it. But Rex is on board before I'm even to the train. He jogs over, hauls himself onto the ladder affixed to the side, and yanks the door right open. Then he swings in, and kneeling down, slams the spike under the door's bottom edge to keep it from closing. It bothers me a little to see exactly what a miraculous recovery he's made. When we left the base, he could barely move his arm, and now he's swinging around like a champion athlete. As if it's nothing. Instinctively, I pat my pocket, reassured by Dust's very presence. Come on, Rex calls. Let's go! I pick up the pace. Unfortunately, so does the train. I manage to get a hand on the ladder, but I can't jump up without stopping first. My feet are scraping the ground now, the train accelerating beyond what I can manage, and I'm forced to pull my legs up and grip the ladder for dear life. If I fall now, I'll probably get pulled under the wheels. My hands are starting to lose their grip. My feet are drifting down again, and the ground is now whistling past below me. If I don't do something, and fast, I'm not going to go any farther, because I'll be nothing but a smear across a few miles of Missouri track. Rex solves that problem. He reaches down and grabs me around the chest just below my arm, then he just lets himself fall back, pulling me with him into the boxcar. We both land on the worn wooden floor with a thud and lay there for a second, winded. Then, he starts to laugh. Woo! He shouts, still laying there, the biggest grin I've seen yet, plastered all over his face. We just jumped onto a moving train! I smile too. Rex just saved my life. Now we're even. Maybe there's hope for him after all. We have to hide once in Columbus, Ohio, when the train stops and rail yard cops check all the cars for stowaways like us, but it's easy to hear them coming. We just duck out of the boxcar as soon as the train lurches to a halt, taking the spike with us, and then circle around, hopping back on once they're gone. It would almost be fun if I wasn't so preoccupied with what's going to happen once we get to New York. I still have no idea how we're going to make it to Plum Island at all, much less how I'm going to get inside, get past whatever security measures the Mogs have, and free the Chimera. It's overwhelming, but I'm starting to doubt myself less now. When I look back and think of how much I've managed to accomplish since I left Ashwood, I'm amazed. I could actually pull this off. However, I still haven't managed to get in touch with Malcolm, and that is worrying me. Why wouldn't he be answering his phone? Unless he never got to the guard at all. I can't let myself think about what that would mean. Rex and I are silent for most of the trip, but somewhere halfway through the journey, as I'm watching the countryside fly by, I surprise myself with the sound of my own voice. Why destroy it all? What's the point? Rex doesn't hesitate before he rattles off one of the most important tenets from the good book. Conquer, consume, cauterize, he shrugs. It's what we do. It's a phrase I've heard so many times that I'll be able to repeat it by heart for the rest of my life. It's the perfect summation of the Mog objective. Travel to a new world, conquer it completely, drain all of its resources, then leave it a burnt-out husk and move on to the next one. It used to make sense to me. But why? I ask. Don't you ever question it? Because it's the way of the universe. It's the way progress happens. The Piken eats the crawl. He doesn't feel guilty about it. He just does it. Because he has to, I argue. Survival is one thing. This is different. Rex's face hardens into a stubborn frown. Look at what happened on Lorien. They had so much power. Their legacies alone should have allowed them to fight us off easily. But they'd gotten soft. Even with all that power, they were weak. Their world was stagnating. It was disgusting. They were happy. What's disgusting about that? He fixes me with a glare so hard that I can practically feel it. I almost forgot who you are, he says coldly. It's the voice of the old Rex. I forgot what you are and what you've done. I won't forget again. Then I know that whatever came over Rex on the course of this trip, it was only temporary. He's not going to change. It's in his blood. And when we get to Plum Island, he won't need me anymore. He'll be back with his true people. He'll have no reason not to turn on me. I look away. I'm alone again. I don't even know where Dust is. He turned himself into a mouse a few hours ago and has been exploring the train on his own ever since. 10 hours after Rex pulled me on board, we arrive in Philly in silence. We haven't said a word since our argument. Dust appears from behind a crate and slides into my pocket as Rex is jumping out into the rail yard. I'm about to follow behind him when I see that he's left the railroad spike behind. I guess he thinks I'm so weak that he doesn't need it. I shove it in my pocket and leap out into the chilly Philadelphia night. We've still barely spoken more than a few words to each other as we're boarding the bus to Manhattan. Then, in theory, it's just a quick hop over to Plum Island. After that, I don't know. I've been weighing my choices. I wonder if Rex has, too. As we were buying our bus tickets, I thought about ditching him altogether, losing him in the crowd and trying to make it to Plum Island on my own. I came pretty close to doing it, and I would have if I thought it would help. It would be pointless, though. He knows where I'm going and what I want. On top of that, I have a feeling I'll need his help getting inside. Then again, it's entirely possible he's already alerted the Mogadorians that he's on his way with his trophy, me, in tow.
Last stop before we hit the Lincoln Tunnel,
the bus driver announces, pulling into a rest area.
20-minute break. I suggest you stretch your legs and use the facilities, people. Traffic in the tunnel can get pretty crazy.
I signal that I'm going to pee and together Rex and I climb out of our seats and follow most of the other passengers off the bus. The ride's been uneventful so far, which suits me just fine. We should be in Manhattan in about an hour, maybe less.
I'm going to grab some more snacks, Rex tells me sullenly as we're walking across the parking lot.
I just nod. He nods back and heads off towards the cluster of vending machines. In the bathroom, I lock the stall door behind me and try Malcolm one more time, praying that this time he'll answer. Still nothing. As soon as I allow myself to consider the worst, my mind feels like a big ball of yarn that's coming quickly unraveled. I can't stop the what-ifs. What if they got caught fleeing Dulce? Or worse, what if the explosion took them out along with all the Mogs there? What if I killed my only friend and his son we went there to save? What if he never found the guard? He's the only one who can lead me to them. If he's not with the guard, that means I have no hope of finding them myself. Ever. No, I tell myself. Malcolm's smart, and he's cautious. He's probably being careful about how he communicates. If he is with the guard, he won't want to risk having his cell phone traced and their location discovered. Anyway, it's not like he's expecting to hear from me. As far as he's concerned, I'm dead. It all makes perfect sense. It just doesn't make me feel any better. I'm stepping back out of the bathroom a few minutes later when it happens. I find my way blocked by two men who are dressed identically in black trench coats, black hats, and black sunglasses. They're both pale beneath those outfits. A little too pale. As soon as I lay eyes on them, they both smile at me, their wide mouths spreading open to reveal toothy, shark-like grins. I turn around instantly and try to shove my way back into the bathroom. Maybe there's a window I can escape through or something. I never get that far. They have me by the arms. Rex is nowhere to be seen. The Mogadorians have found me.
Chapter 9.
Took a while to catch up with you, Adamus, the one on the right says. You almost managed to slip past us.
Almost, the one on the left echoes. He pulls his hands out of his pockets. No surprise he's holding a dagger in one and a blaster in the other. Standard Mog scout weaponry. Lucky for me, what I'm carrying is non-standard. And after my initial shock, I'm more resigned than frightened. I've been looking over my shoulder for Mogs this whole time, and in a way, it's almost a relief that they're finally here. Still, there's something I need to know. How'd you find me?
They just laugh at that. Unlike me and Rex and the rest of the Trueborn, most scouts are Vatborn and have the triangular fang-like teeth to prove it. Their smiles really do look like a shark's. They don't need to tell me the answer. I already know. It was Rex. It had to have been. While I was in the bathroom trying to call Malcolm, he was calling in the big guns. He was betraying me. And I hate him for that. I'm not scared. I'm not sad. I'm certainly not relieved anymore. I'm just angry. The Vatborn's laughter stops when the ground beneath them ripples upwards like it's water, tossing them off their feet. The one on the left loses his grip on his blaster, and I dive for it, scoop it up, and shoot him point blank. Poof! I'm already sighting on the second one by the time he crumbles to ash. If Rex thinks I'm not a worthy opponent just because I'm not as big as him, or because I don't believe that Satrakis Ra's stupid fortune cookie rules are words to live by, he needs to think again. I have to get out of here. There are too many people in too small a space, and if there's going to be a big battle here, there's no telling how many innocent people could be hurt. Before anyone can stop me, I make a beeline for the rear exit and slam right through it without stopping. 100 heads turn to stare at me, but I don't care. Outside, I find myself in a wide-open parking lot, empty except for a few untended 16-wheelers. I'm looking frantically for cover when I hear the distinctive, high-pitched whine of a Mog hand cannon powering up to fire from somewhere behind me. I hurl myself to the side, hitting the ground hard just as the energy blast sizzles past me. The pavement is smoking, a circular hole in the exact spot
where I was just standing. Glancing up from the ground, I see a quartet of Mog soldiers tromping toward me, rifles and hand cannons aimed in my direction. Too bad for them. Now they've pissed me off. I feel my face clenching up in fury, and my body trembles as I send a quake through the ground. The two Mogs nearest to me go toppling like bowling pins. In the confusion, I dive behind one of the trucks, buying myself some time while my remaining pursuers split up to look for me. When I don't hear anything for a minute or so, I peek out quickly from behind the cab and see another soldier coming toward me. He's alone. Too easy. He's a goner before he even knows I've zapped him with my stolen blaster. 5 down, 1 left, not counting Rex. Of course, that's assuming that there aren't more I don't know about yet. I should be so lucky. I hear more footsteps approaching, and getting louder. They're coming fast. I suppose it was too much to hope the high command had only sent 2 scouts and 4 soldiers after me. But when I poke my head over the cab again, and see dozens of Mogs pouring through the parking lot from every possible direction, blasters and cannons at the ready, I have to say it seems like overkill. I guess I should be flattered. Not just that they think I'm worth the trouble, but that whoever sent them here considers me such a formidable adversary. Ducking down, I peer below the truck and spot a Mog marching toward me, shooting at my shelter to keep me pinned down while he advances. Too bad he wasn't watching the tires. I shoot him in the leg, and when he drops, put another blast in his head, finishing him off. Then I pull myself to my feet and scan the area. Dust! I scream. Where the hell is he? For that matter, where's Rex? Not that I really want to know. More soldiers round the corner of the building, and my stomach clenches. They're spreading out in front of me, so I won't be able to take them all down at once. I crouch behind the truck again, but I know I won't be able to hold out like this much longer. How is this at all worth it? I've never hated my own race more than I do right now. Mostly, though, I hate Rex. Not because he betrayed me. No, I hate him because, before he could betray me, he made me trust him. At least my anger's good for something. I focus in on it and stomp a foot on the ground. This tremor is the strongest one yet. I can feel it flowing out through my body like a giant ocean wave originating in my ribcage. Some of the soldiers topple. Others wobble but stay standing. 1 or 2 drop their weapons. I grit my teeth. Using my legacy is exhausting me, and I don't know how much longer I'll be able to keep it up. But I have to. I stomp again. A few more go down, but now the rest are shooting at me. I'm trying to figure out what to do next when I hear a ferocious roar. Glancing over my vehicular shield, I see a large, tawny shape leap from the trees and grab one soldier by the shoulder, yanking him to the ground. Dust roars and lunges again, his massive jaw snapping shut like a trap around his quarry's neck. The soldier's scream dies mid-shriek, his body convulsing as it turns to ash. But the lion has already moved on. He's ripping through the soldiers easily, their fire barely slowing him down. Dust claws and bites, not stopping to consider any individual enemy for more than a split second before moving on. The Mogs, still left standing, are confused. They didn't plan for this, and now they're not sure whether they're supposed to be shooting me, or Dust, or whether it's time to retreat altogether. I take advantage of the confusion. 2 soldiers are backed up, almost to me, and I shoot them both before they remember that I'm still a threat too. Dust's finished off another soldier, and several more have taken shelter around the side of the main structure. Collapsing something is one trick I got pretty good at with Malcolm, and though it causes spikes of pain to shoot through my forehead, I shake the roof loose and drop it on those soldiers, easily crushing them. That leaves only 2, and they move away from Dust and me both, shooting at him to keep him back and edging away toward the trees where they must have a ship waiting. If they reach it, I'm toast. I'm using my legacy far beyond anything I've ever tried in the past, and every time I cause a new quake, I'm more and more exhausted. My vision's starting to go dark around the edges, but I know I don't have any choice except to fight through it. I concentrate and send a tremor under a nice thick tree, the same way I did to the guard station back at Dolce Base, It topples with a loud groan and crushes one of the soldiers beneath its trunk. The last Mog simply turns and runs, but dust is on him in an instant in a blur of teeth and claws. A few seconds later, he's trotting back toward me, his mouth coated in ash. He doesn't seem fazed by this. That makes one of us. "Thanks," I manage to mumble weakly when he reaches me. Then, everything goes black. When I wake up, I'm in the passenger seat of a car flying along the highway, my head still pounding and my vision still blurry. The New York City skyline is barely recognizable over the dashboard as an abstract haze of lights. I have no idea how I got here or where I'm headed. The events of the past few hours bounce around in my skull like a million ping-pong balls. Everything's jumbled and hard to make sense of. Groaning, I look over to the driver's seat. Behind the wheel is Rex. Even in my messed-up state, I fumble with the door handle. I'll jump out right here, I think. I'd rather be instant roadkill than spend another second letting him think I trust him. "Hey," he says, when he sees me fumbling to escape. Before I can get the door open, he reaches to the console on the dashboard and locks all the doors. I'm trapped. "Calm down," he says. "I don't know what you did in that parking lot, but whatever it was, it took a lot out of you." I don't want to hear it. "Where the hell were you?" I demand. "What the hell happened back there?" Rex barely glances up from the road. "Same thing that happened to you," he says calmly, as if I just asked him to remind me of tomorrow's weather forecast. "The Mogs got to me, too. They must think I'm on your side now. I fought them off. But by the time I got rid of them and made it to you, this guy was already on it." He points to a lump on the dashboard, which I only then realize is dust in his lizard form. "When I found you, you were passed out on the pavement, and dust's just sitting there, practically on top of you, watching over you like he's your mom or something. He barely even let me come near you. Anyway, what's done is done. We got away. What do you think of the car? I stole it." If he expects me to believe any of that story, he's an idiot. I want to tell him so, but with my head still swimming, I only manage to spit out one short sentence. "Screw you, Rex," I say, just as everything fades to black again. Chapter 10. I come to in another parking lot, finally feeling myself again. Sort of, at least. Based on the light streaming into the car, it must be morning. Rex has the windows rolled down and the air smells vaguely of the ocean. "Finally," he says when he sees me stirring. "I was beginning to think you were gone for good." I sit up. I look at him. I can't believe how stupid I feel. I knew exactly what he was up to all along, and I let him get away with it anyway. "You betrayed me," I say. He just laughs. "I knew you were going to say that. Kind of funny, right? You're a traitor to your entire race, and you're mad at me." I get ready to hit him with every bit of tectonic force I have left at my disposal. But as soon as I so much as think about it, I start to feel faint again. "You seriously expect me to believe you weren't the one who called in the Mogadorian Mafia? You go mysteriously missing, just as they show up, and then you somehow don't reappear until I fought them all off?" "I told you," he said. "They attacked me too." "Sure. Right." I know he's full of shit, but I honestly don't know what to do about it. What I don't understand is why he's toying with me like this. If he wanted to kill me, he could have killed me by now. He could have called in more Mogs. Instead, I'm still alive, still uncaptured, sitting unscathed in the passenger seat of a carjacked sedan with dust on my lap, whining at me. I look out the window, and I see where we are. Sort of, at least. We're somewhere on the water. A foghorn blares, and I squint out the window to see a ferry crawling across the water and into view. "You wanted to go to Plum Island, right?" Rex says, seeing the confused look on my face. "How else are we going to get there except by boat?" I still don't believe he didn't give the Mogs our location, but then that doesn't explain why he came to get me. why he helped me escape. He could have just left me at the rest stop, left me to get caught by the Mogs, by the cops, whoever. I need some air. I need to get out of this car. Rex doesn't try to stop me when I open the car door. Dust jumps out onto the pavement, and I'm right behind him. Rex finds me on a bench half an hour later. I don't know what else to do, so I'm just sitting. I've tried calling Malcolm. No answer. I tried picturing one in my head. It would have helped just to imagine her face, but it wouldn't come to me. Even Golden Retriever Dust has given up trying to make me feel better. He's just lying at my feet. I didn't tell them, Rex says. He's standing a few paces away, but doesn't try to come any closer. The scouts have been following you all along. They missed you a few times, and then I think you gave them the drop when you decided to hop the train. But they were going to catch up eventually. Where were you then? I ask. Don't try to tell me they attacked you too. The truth? Yeah, I say. For once, the truth. Rex pauses. I was hiding, he finally says. They might have already seen me with you, but I didn't want them to see me fighting to save you, to think that I'm a traitor. So I hid. I examine his face for signs that he's lying. I honestly have no idea. I don't know why it matters, but it does. So, you were just going to let them kill me? He looks at the sky. Yeah, he says. I guess I was, if it came to that. But now you're helping me? Yep. I don't get it. Why? Rex shuffles his feet nervously. I don't know, he says. I still believe in the Mogadorian cause. I still believe in Satrakis Ra's principles. When it comes time to fight, I'll be there with the rest of my brothers, if I'm still allowed to be. War is in my blood. But I'm helping you anyway. You don't have to believe me if you don't want to. I can't explain it even to myself. But it's the truth. I don't answer him. I don't know how. So do you want to go to Plum Island and rescue the Chimera or not? He finally asks. The ferry doesn't go to Plum Island. There's no reason it should. Normal Americans need the highest level of clearance even to set foot on the island. That rules out getting there openly. But in a seaside community like this, most people own a boat, at least a little one. Rex and I spend the afternoon peering into unattended garages until we find ourselves hauling a small rowboat towards the harbor. We stash it behind some trees in the neighboring park until the sun's going down, and we see the last ferry pull in. Then we wait another half hour just to be sure no one will spot us and drag it to the end of the dock. From there it's easy enough to flip it over and lay it into the water, climb in, and start rowing. While I'd spent my morning passed out, Rex had been coming up with a plan to get us inside the facility. Sitting across from me in our rowboat, he explains it to me. It's so simple that it sounds absurd. I'll tell them you're my prisoner, he says, that I tracked you from New Mexico until I captured you and brought you here. They're looking for you, right? They send that many scouts to get you. They think you're important. It might even go all the way up the chain to Satrakis Ra. If I bring you in, there's no chance they'll turn you away. They could just shoot me on sight, I say. Rex scrunches his face and shakes his head. In the distance, I see lights. We're getting closer. Nah, he says. First, they'll want to know how you took down Dulce. Hell, I want to know that myself. A quick grin surfaces. Then they'll shoot you. Gee, thanks. I glance over to where Dust is gliding along beside us in hawk form, tilting to one side from time to time, so a wingtip knifes through the water. We don't know anything about who they've got there, how they're set up, what they've heard, what... Rex stops me. Will you relax? Trust me. I know how our military works. I've got this covered. If I had to make a list of all the people I trusted, it would be a really short list, and Rex wouldn't be on it. Even if I did trust him, I still wouldn't like the plan. What if they know Rex has been working with me all this time? What if they kill us before we even get the chance to explain ourselves? It all relies too much on faith. And after yesterday, faith is something I'm pretty much all out of. But before I can argue, Dust lands on the edge of the boat. He's flapping his wings furiously, and then he shifts into cat form. Just as quickly, he changes again, this time into a wolf. He's too big for the boat and nearly tips over. But now he's shifting so quickly that I start to lose track of what he's even supposed to be. And he's making a noise that's so loud, I have to put my fingers in my ears, halfway between a howl and a trumpet blast, deep and quivery. I've never heard anything like it. "Dust," I say. "What's wrong?" I put my hand out to rub him in the hope that it will calm him down. His body feels like liquid, but it does the trick. He's starting to get control of himself again. As he settles into lizard form, he finally quiets down. He's still agitated, though. He's darting around the floor of the boat, cocking his head frantically in every direction, sniffing the air. It looks like he's hearing something that Rex and I can't, almost like there's something calling to him. It's very weird, but I don't know what to do about it. The island's close enough now that I think I can just see where that harbor opens up. Rex pulls the oars in. "You ready to do this?" he asks. I'm not ready at all, but I nod. At least Dust has settled down enough to climb into the pocket of my hoodie. I can still feel him twitching nervously in there, but it seems like he's getting back to normal. Rex doesn't pay any attention to how uneasy this is making me. He just digs through his pockets until he pulls out the plastic ties that he bought from a local hardware store while we've been waiting for the ferries to clear out for the day. "Give me your wrists," he says. "Every bit of my common sense is telling me not to do it. Letting myself be tied up and marched into a Mogadorian stronghold by a Mog I barely trust doesn't sound like the most brilliant scheme, does it? Certain I'm walking into some kind of incredibly elaborate trap, I offer up my hands anyway. I've come this far. What else can I do but take the risk?" Within seconds, Rex has me expertly bound. It's almost like we're back to the way we started at Dulce. One guard and one prisoner. This time with our roles reversed. Hopefully it's just for show. We're a few meters from the shore when a blinding searchlight engulfs us in its dazzling beam and a booming voice calls out,
"Stop! Identify yourself!"
Rex straightens.
"Rexicus Eternus, from Dulce," he shouts back. "And a prisoner!"
He grabs my hands and raises them so those watching can see the restraints. The pause has me sweating despite the chill coming off the waves, but finally the voice replies,
"Come ahead!"
They don't offer to pick us up, but instead stay back and let Rex row us the rest of the way in. Typical Mogs. "Shouldn't there be regular soldiers here?" I whisper. "Instead of Mogadorians?" "Used to be that way," Rex says. "But we're getting more and more power in the American government lately. Pretty soon, the White House will be run by Mogadorians too." It's a scary thought, and one that would have made me incredibly excited just a few short years ago. At the sound of the Mogadorian shouting at us, Dust has crawled from my pocket. And before I have time to even say goodbye, he's turned into a hummingbird and is gone into the night sky. I know it's for the best. If I'm going to be thrown into a cell, I don't want him trapped in there with me. Nonetheless, I feel incredibly vulnerable without him. The feeling only intensifies when I see the squad of soldiers waiting for us on the dock, weapons drawn. They wait until our little rowboat bumps up against the logs, and then reach down and haul us up.
"Who's this?"
the Mog officer in charge demands, staring into my eyes and grabbing me roughly by the arm.
"A low-life trader," Rex replies. "Artemis Sutek, son of General Andrakis Sutek."
He punches me in the stomach, hard enough to double me over and leave me gasping for breath. The captain's frowning at us. He's trueborn, of course, but the underlings flanking him are all vatborn, big and pale and typically creepy.
"Why bring him here?" the captain asks for a second. "And what exactly happened at Dulce? We lost all communication with it. Sent some scouts in, but they reported the whole place destroyed."
"He happened,"
Rex replies, gesturing towards me. The captain's frown deepens, and Rex hurries to explain.
I was stationed at Dulce Base. This traitor showed up with a human ally and attacked. They blew up the base. I was only stunned. I woke up in time to see him slip away, so I followed him all the way from Dulce to here. Once I was sure this was his next target, I captured him and brought him in for questioning.
The captain nods. I can't believe he's buying this load of horseshit. But he is.
Good job, he says. We'll notify the general and find out if he wants to question his son personally. In the meantime, Rexicus, you'll need to be debriefed.
He gestures at two of the soldiers.
Throw the traitor in a cell for now, but don't get too carried away. The general will want to handle his punishment personally.
Then he leads Rex away while the guards grab me and march me toward a long, low building a few hundred feet from the harbor. Damn, it's not even in the main building. This is going to make things very difficult. When they throw me into my cell, I'm still trying to decide whether Rex sold me out or if everything is going exactly according to plan.
Chapter 11.
I don't know how long it's been. Hours? Days? But no one has come by since those guards threw me in here. I guess they're taking their commander's orders to leave me alone until my father comes to retrieve me to Hart. I'm cursing myself for thinking Rex was actually on my side, for letting him get the better of me. I thought I could trust him. Then I hear the click of the lock on my cell door. It's too dark to make out who's standing there, but I easily recognize Rex's voice.
Sorry I took so long, he says.
Then something hits me in the face and chest. Something lightweight, flexible, a little scratchy.
Put those on.
It's pants and a jacket, all standard military issue, and I hurriedly do as I'm told.
Where have you been? I demand as I change. I had to be sure they didn't suspect anything,
Rex replies, holding the cell door wide open and beckoning me to follow.
And I had to find out where they were holding the Chimera.
Here. He hands me a military cap, and I pull that on as well. Smart thinking. I'm clearly a Mog, but my long hair definitely isn't a soldier's cut. Plus the cap helps hide my face, in case anyone might recognize me.
So, where are they?
I ask, as he leads me out of the building. I'm surprised there aren't any guards at all, until I see a small pile of ash in one corner, and another behind a desk near the entryway. I'm a little surprised Rex was willing to kill to get me out of here. Surprised, but grateful.
They're keeping them in the disease center, he replies, easing open the brig's front door and glancing out before nodding and motioning me through.
But not the main annex. It's mostly Marines and human scientists. There's a second building off to the side, staffed entirely by our people. They're in there.
That makes sense. Even though the High Command clearly has some kind of deal with the U.S. government, they wouldn't want to let any of the humans close to anything that could be used against us.
And the Chimera would definitely qualify.
How do we get there?
He grins as we step around the side of the jail and stop at a military jeep that's sitting there, already idling. Rex doesn't hit the lights until we're clear of the last building and our view of the harbor is swallowed up among the trees. It only takes a couple minutes to curve up and around to the disease center, the advantages of an island that's only a few miles in any direction. The main building is enormous and looks like a research lab crossed with a school, but sure enough, there's a smaller, warehouse-like building off to one side. We head over that way. There are Mog soldiers standing guard outside, but they salute Rex and step aside to let us pass.
Interesting.
This is our main base on the island, he explains, once we're through the doors and walking along a wide, rough, cement-floored hall. Where they're keeping the Chimera will require security clearance, but out here, we're good. Which is obviously true, but I can't help wondering how we're going to get back out past those same guards without setting off alarms, especially with however many Chimera there are in tow.
We lucked out, too, Rex is saying.
We head up one flight of stairs, then another.
They were being held in the basement, but 2 days ago, I hear they all went nuts,
they trashed the place completely, so they were moved up here until stronger cells could be built. 2 days ago? I bet that's about the same time that Dust started freaking out on the boat. It's all got to be connected. Speaking of which, have you seen Dust? Do you know where he is?
He's out there, Rex answers without glancing back.
He found me when I was grabbing the Jeep. He knows what he's doing. He'll find you when the time's right. I nod slowly. I wish Dust was with me right now, but I know Rex is right. Dust hasn't let me down yet. We stop on the fourth floor and exit the stairwell. The ceilings up here are 12 feet tall at least, and enormous windows cover most of the walls, though they're barred. Despite the concrete floors and thick stone outer walls and corrugated metal inner walls, the space still has a light, airy feel. And doors. Lots and lots of doors. They're up here somewhere, Rex assures me, opening the first door at hand and peering in. He shakes his head and slides it shut again. I open another door, but it leads to a small office. Empty, fortunately. Nope. The next one is a supply closet. Also not much help. The door after that, however, opens onto a large room that looks like an operating theater. There are instruments arrayed on trays positioned around a large exam table. It's also empty, which I consider a very good thing. I really wouldn't want to walk in on a surgery, especially not one performed by my people. They're a lot more interested in carving up than in putting back together.
Over here, Rex calls.
And I see he's one door down from me, but on the other side of the hall. I cross quickly and peer inside with him. It's like a big kennel, with wire cages lined up against the far wall. Could this be it? Shut the door, I whisper, stepping through to study the cages and their inhabitants. The first cage looks empty, save for some sort of goo smeared across the floor. But when I step a little closer, the goo suddenly rears up, flowing into a shape like a raccoon or maybe a weasel, narrow and wiry with dark, matted fur, a sharply pointed face and beady little eyes. And then it screams. I've never heard anything like it, and I hope I never will again. It's high and shrill and makes my entire body feel like a glass that's about to shatter. I stumble back a pace, off balance, then another until the screeching stops. The goo settles, dropping back to the cage floor. Rex and I stare at each other. What the hell was that? Whatever it was, there's nothing I can do to help it. Not if it's going to scream bloody murder and completely paralyze me every time I get close. The next cage is empty. Though, judging from the soiled newspapers on the bottom, it hasn't been that way for long. The third cage contains a bird, about the size of a parrot. It has blue feathers ranging from a deep purple so dark they look almost black to a pale blue-white like winter itself. The bird has no wings, though. Where those appendages should be are two stumps, stitched and bandaged. It caws at me, a single long chirp-like wail, and the sound brings tears to my eyes. I look over at Rex, but he looks just as horrified. Either he's a better actor than I realized, or he has no idea what we'd find.
Are these chimera? He asks, his voice hushed and rough.
I don't know. They might be. I shake my head. I don't think either of those two are going anywhere, though. Even if we opened their cages, how would we get them to follow us? Especially without risking whatever others we find. I hate to abandon any of them, but I think we have to leave this pair here. I glance in the other cages quickly, but they're all empty. I see a second door against the side wall, and I hurry over to that, pull it open, and rush through, almost slamming into a pair of mogs that are standing in front of another row of cages. One of them is short and wiry and wearing a lab coat, definitely a scientist. The other one's big and burly, though, and in military gear. They both look up as I barrel in, and the soldier's hand automatically goes for the blaster at his side.
Great.
What? Who?
The scientist starts, but I shut him up by slamming into him as hard as I can. He flies backwards into the soldier, who stumbles a step, his hands going up automatically to catch his companion. They both turn to ash a second later, and I glance back to see Rex in the doorway, blaster in hand. He did that, just like he killed the Mogs who were guarding my cell. "Why?" I start. "I promised you I'd help you, and I'm helping you," he says. "Let's just leave it at that." Then he looks past me. "Jackpot," he whispers. I follow his gaze to see what he's talking about. At least 4 of the cages here are occupied. Nope, 5. And all of them, well, the first one has a small dog, the second a little pig, the third a cat, the fourth a raccoon, and the fifth a brightly colored bird. Then I blink, and now they're an owl, a goat, a rat, a beaver, and a monkey. Then they shift again, and again, a lot like dust did the other night, only this is constant, cycling from shape to shape to shape, fast enough to make them dizzying to watch. "Is that normal?" Rex asks. He sounds just as surprised as I am. The continual shape-shifting is unsettling, to say the least. "I don't know," I admit. Then I notice a clipboard on the ground by my feet. The scientist must have dropped it. Picking it up, I see a list of subjects, with notes next to each one. Notes like, 100 cc injected, change rate increased tenfold, and lobotomy performed, cohesion shattered. Bile rises in my throat, and I have to gulp a few times before I can answer. No. They've been experimenting on them already. At this point, I have no idea how useful these surviving creatures will be. I'd hope to find a bunch more like dust, and instead, I have 5 out-of-control shape-changing animals. Still, there's no question they're chimera, and I don't waste any more time wondering. Instead, I step over to their cages and yank them open one by one. "It's okay," I assure them, loud enough for all of them to hear me at once, but low enough that I hope my voice won't carry beyond these walls. "We're here to help." I have no idea if they understand me, but I figure it can't hurt. For a minute, none of them move, and I can't blame them. I don't know how long they've been here or what's been done to them, but they don't have any reason to trust a Mog, or, for all I know, humans. The one that's now, for the moment, back to being a monkey, is the first one to edge over to its open door, poke its head through, and then chitter at the others, shifting back and forth between forms as they pour out of their prison. A second later, they're all loose, crawling and swinging and pacing and fluttering every which way. "Right," I tell Rex, "time to go." Almost on cue, a siren starts blaring. Flashing lights accompany it out in the hall. Then a voice erupts from speakers in the ceiling.
"Attention! A prisoner has escaped the brig. Adamus Sutek was last seen wearing blue jeans and a black shirt. He is 5'10", slight of build, with long hair. He is unarmed but a known traitor. If found, detain if possible. Shoot if necessary. The same for any accomplices."
"Yeah," Rex agrees, shaking his head. "Definitely time to go." Chapter 12. We race out of the room, into the hall and down the stairwell with the chimera following behind us. Rex clamps a hand on my arm and hauls me back just before I start bounding down the stairs.
"Not that way," he calls after me.
"They'll start checking the building at the bottom and work their way up.
But there's an elevator in the back that you can only access from up here. If you can fight your way to it, you can get out that way." I nod and let him wheel me around and half drag me up the stairs to the 5th floor. Judging by the door we've come to, which is painted bright red and is made from some kind of heavy, extra-reinforced steel, we've reached the part of the building that they really, really want to keep people out of. With a grunt, Rex yanks it open and we step inside. The ceilings are just as high up here, but there aren't any inner walls. Instead, it's just one big room,
crowded with computer stations around the edges and a massive topographical map of the East Coast in the center of the room.
This is obviously the command center.
"Quick, hide," I whisper,
and duck behind a computer station, Rex does the same. I worry what the Chimera will do, but they all stick with me, and even though they're still changing shape constantly, they all shift to smaller creatures, mice and lizards and dragonflies. Picking out, I see a few Mogs here, typing in front of monitors or marking things on transparent touch screens suspended in midair. Others are gathered in small clusters, discussing something in low tones. Nobody's noticed us yet, and they aren't mobilizing to hunt for an escaped prisoner either. I guess their work is more important. Our luck can't last, though. And? Next problem. Other than the stairs we just ran up, I don't see any other way out. This may not have been Rex's best plan. A siren begins to blare again, and I cringe, figuring this is it. They've spotted me, and they're calling guards to surround and overpower us. Even if I bring the whole building down the way I did Dulce Base, I might still be trapped, and we're currently 5 floors up. If the building goes, that's a long way down. But this siren is different, more of a whoop than a shriek. And when someone starts speaking over it, what he says is not what I expected.
"Attention all units," the announcer states, his words slightly rushed but clear. "Assemble at once. Guard located. Full-scale assault about to begin. Repeat, all units assemble at once. Full-scale assault about to begin."
They found the guard? Full-scale assault? I look at Rex, whose own eyes are darting everywhere. He looks worried, but excited too, with that same gleam he had when we jumped onto the train. He zeroes in on something, and I follow his gaze to a Mog officer leaning over a console. His screen is showing something. I realize all of them have the same image up now, and I rise to a crouch and edge closer to get a better look. It's a streak map, but it doesn't look familiar. There's a lake instead of an ocean. It's not New York. The others in the room are rushing about, either speaking quickly into walkie-talkies or racing towards the stairs. But this guy is still at his desk. What if he turns and sees me? I've apparently just moved down on the priority list, but I'm sure if he realizes who I am, he'll still grab me. I have to chance it, though. If that's where the guard have been hiding, Malcolm may be there as well. I take a few more steps, and now I can make out more details, including place names. Shed Aquarium, Water Tower Place, North Lakeshore Drive, Lake Michigan. It's Chicago. They're in Chicago. And the building that's dead center on the screen is the John Hancock Center. That must be where the guard are. Just as I realize that, the Mog sitting there turns and sees me.
"Hey!"
he starts, half rising from his chair. He looks confused, like he knows I'm not supposed to be there but hasn't totally figured out that I'm the escaped prisoner. Then he notices something at my shoulder, and his eyes go wide. Out of the corner of my eye, I see a butterfly there, and a second later, it's a hummingbird, then a bumblebee. Crap. He's just realized who I am. I'm only a few steps away from him at this point. I close the distance fast and slam my fist into his jaw as hard as I can. His eyes glaze over, and he slumps back into his chair. A quick scan of the room tells me no one else noticed. I guess all those years of sparring with Ivan were worth something after all.
"You've got to get out of here," Rex warns, moving up beside me and grabbing my arm again. "Now, while everyone's rushing to deploy."
I nod, then stop.
"I've got to get out of here?"
He looks down, then away.
"Look," he starts, "you saved my life. I owe you. And I didn't betray you. I haven't, and I won't. But,"
he shrugs,
"I'm not like you. I already told you that. I was just keeping my promise. I get that you probably have reasons for what you did, and maybe they make sense to you, but not to me. This is where I belong. It's who I am."
It's obvious that there's no changing his mind, and he's not like me. As far as I know, no other Mog is. He believes everything we were taught about being the superior race and having the right to rule, to control, to destroy. Maybe he's come to appreciate things a little more from our time together, but at his core, he's still a loyal soldier. And sooner or later,
I believe he'd betray me. Our beliefs are just too different. So I just nod and hold out my hand. He clasps it, claps me on the back, and gives me a quick grin.
"Tell Dust I said goodbye," he says, already turning towards the stairs. Then he's gone.
If he's lucky, no one will realize he helped me. I actually hope that's the case. I'm left alone in the command center, me and a handful of messed-up Chimera, and a bunch of MOG officers who are just starting to notice the fugitive and his strange menagerie in their midst.
"It's the traitor!"
one of them shouts, breaking that frozen moment of recognition.
"Get him!"
He rushes toward me, along with a few of the others. That's when a huge white owl comes crashing through the window. It's Dust! Shattered glass is flying everywhere, and before it can even hit the ground, he's already shifting. By the time he lands, he's blocking the way between me and the Mogadorians. He's a wolf again, just like the first time I saw him. This time, though, he lets out a guttural, almost primordial howl. The first of the guards doesn't even have time to disintegrate before he's been torn to shreds. At that, the rest of them do something I've never seen a Mogadorian do before. They run.
Chapter 13.
Several hours later, I'm speeding along the highway in a stolen car packed with Chimera, heading toward Chicago. The creatures have finally stabilized their shapes and have mostly managed to settle down. It's still the weirdest road trip I've ever taken, not to mention the smelliest. But I'm making good time. I'm almost to the Illinois border, when after the fifth try, Malcolm's phone finally picks up.
"Malcolm!"
I shout immediately, juggling the phone to my other hand as the light changes and I ease through the intersection.
"Where have you been?"
But the voice that answers isn't his.
"This is Sam."
There's a pause.
"Adam, is that you?"
"Sam?" It takes me a second. We didn't exactly get introduced, and I'm a little stressed right now. Then I remember.
"Sam, where's your father?"
"He's..." "Never mind, it doesn't matter." I switch the phone to my other hand so I can drive properly.
"Listen to me, Sam. You're in Chicago, right? The John Hancock Center?"
I can hear him suck in his breath.
How did you know that?" "They know, Sam!"
I don't mean to shout, but I know I am.
"They know, and they're coming for you."
An oncoming car honks at me as I swerve into its lane, and I'm forced to drop the phone onto the seat beside me and concentrate on driving.
"I warned them.
That's all I can do right now. I can only hope they listen, and that they're prepared. They've just got to hold out for a little while." I glance behind me to the back seat. Dust has taken the form of a cat again, and is curled up around his recovered kin. He looks up and meets my gaze, his golden eyes to my black ones, and growls slightly. But I know that warning isn't meant for me. It's for the ones who did this to the other Chimera. "Just hang on, Malcolm," I pray as I press down on the gas, and the car leaps forwards, racing into the night. "I'm coming, and I've got the cavalry with me. I hope one, wherever she is now, knows what I've done, what I'm doing. I'd like to think she does, that there's still a part of her out there somewhere. No, one's gone. I finally accept the truth. If she lives on in any way at all, it's not because she's a ghost or a lingering psychic imprint. All that's left of her is what I've held on to in my memories, the things she told me, the way she taught me to live. She's not coming back. I don't need her to. I know she's proud of me, because I'm proud of myself. Because I remember her."
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of I Am Number 4, The Lost Files, Secret Histories, by Pittacus Lore, performed by Kaleo Griffith and John Reynolds. This program was produced by Dion Audio Services. The director was Bob Dion. Executive producer, Caitlin Gehring. Text copyright 2013 by Pittacus Lore. Production copyright 2013 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.